Welcome to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later, where we research the response of our past and review their relevance for today. This is your host, Moshe Kurtz. Welcome, my friends, to another episode of Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. We have the privilege today to be joined by Rabbi Aryeh Klapper, and we're going to be discussing a really fundamental tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda, in which we explore the limits and parameters of a very popular concept called Pikuach Nefesh, the imperative to preserve life. Rabbi Klapper heads the Center for Modern Torah Leadership and its flagship Summer Beit Midrash, which has developed amazing male and female Torah leaders for 27 years. Rabbi Klapper co-founded the Boston Aguna Task Force, served on the Boston Beit Din for decades, and is an internationally consulted posek. He's the author of Divine Will and Human Experience, Explorations of the Halachic System and Its Values. And he's also the host of the Taking Responsibility for Torah podcast. You can sign up for his weekly Torah essays, which, God willing, we will link in the description. And I particularly am glad to have you, Rabbi Klapper. I particularly admire that when we deal with many complicated topics that face the Jewish community and the Orthodox community in particular, I always appreciate how you're able to approach things that many would approach from a standpoint of sensationalism. You always do a great job analyzing things methodologically and logically. And so it's wonderful to have you analyze what is potentially a very fraught tshuva, as our listeners will hear about in just a moment. So we're about to do a tshuva of the Noda B'Yehuda. I think this is the first Noda B'Yehuda that we're doing on the podcast. Can you tell us just very briefly what we have to know about the Noda B'Yehuda? What's the shaila? What's the question we're dealing with in its tshuva? And I'd be curious to know, obviously you have a whole arsenal, I'm sure, of tshuvas you could have chosen. Why this particular question interested you in particular?
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kurtz. It's a joy to be here with you. Love the fascination with tshuvot. I'm always fascinated by tshuvot. The reason I picked this one is that I think it's a marvelous, clear illustration of how a great posek works in response to responding to reality and to sources at the same time in situations where there is no clear answer. So we're gonna try and understand exactly what the Noda B'Yehuda is doing with his sources in the context of this tshuva, and then it's also a great way to explore through reception history how a creative idea in halacha plays out over time, and it'll force us to think all sorts of, I hope, challenging thoughts about the way in which poskim have to function in response to changing circumstances. The Noda B'Yehuda lives basically throughout the 18th century, 1713 to 1793. By the time this tshuva is written, I don't think we have an exact date. I don't recall exactly. He's already a rabbi in Prague, which he assumes at a fairly young age. But the question comes from his son-in-law in England. So to understand the reality, So let's talk about what the tshuva is, about whether the Jewish community should permit the bodies of its community to be autopsied for the sake of gaining medical knowledge, and specifically to improve surgery for something called Evan HaKis, which could be kidney stone or bladder stone. To understand what the question is, you have to understand that at the same time, medical practice is being transformed in Europe by dissection. The study of dead bodies has always been forbidden, but there's been a marvelous demonstration of how you can improve surgery, and specifically surgery on stones, by doing autopsies and dissections. He knows this well. Rabbi Yitzchak Blau brought my attention to this book by Wendy Moore called The Knife Man, The Extraordinary Life and Times of John Hunter, Father of Modern Surgery. You see it here, a fascinating, fascinating book, although not with squeamish. And it tells you how in England at that time, a man named John Hunter was bringing in European techniques, and thereby he developed a whole new method of medical training, which required fresh cadavers. Now, the problem is that the government only permits dissection on cadavers of executed criminals. But John Hunter's methods were so successful, his surgery was so successful, that there was an enormous demand for cadavers. to the point where, and Wendy Moore has amazing descriptions where when criminals were hung, there would be gangs from the family and from opposing doctors trying to pull the victim off the gallows so they could have them for their medical school.
Oh, wow.
There were whole cemeteries being dug up, right? Anybody was buried, the family had to put guards at the cemetery, or there would be doctors' gangs coming through, right, digging up the bodies. Now, so here I want to get the historical setting of this teshuva, because there are two things that I believe Zinoni Bito understood perfectly. He understood, one, that autopsies and dissection genuinely contributed to the advance of medical knowledge and saved lives. Right? To deny that would mean to have denied the reality, right, the reality that was known already through Europe. And secondly, he knew that Christians objected religiously to autopsies. So if Jews did and dissection for medical knowledge, so if Jews did not object, there would be no kvura for Jews in Europe.
It sounds interesting. I recall, perhaps it's the Mugging Avraham, a discussion about having Amir la'akim, non-Jews, building a shul on Shabbos, and he makes the argument that about, well, the Christians aren't having work done through a harama on their holy days. So it's interesting that we're kind of looking over our shoulder at what the Christians consider to be ethical as well.
This is true, but I want to sharpen it. It's not just that we're worried what they'll say. There will be no Jews buried.
Oh, wow.
Because there's such a demand for bodies, that every Jewish body will be dissected. And dissected bodies were not being treated with great respect afterwards. There's no refrigeration.
Oh, wow.
Right? So with no refrigeration, right, when you have large medical schools, they need bodies every day. And they're doing gross dissection. Right? So I think that's really, you know, you can, even if you thought this was the most important thing in the world, you have to realize what the consequence is if Jews are free game and Christians are not. The consequences are really no Jews would be buried.
Oh my God!
Right, so that's a great thing for them even to be confronting. Right, it really is important to medical knowledge, and if Jews get ahead of the curve, right, you just give up kavura, and you know, then you can think about the question of how Jewish bodies are going to be treated in Christian medical school in 18th century England.
Wow.
Okay, so that's our setting. Now, the fascinating structure of this tshuva is that it comes with a packet of prior responses. Right, Rabbi, the Rebbe's son-in-law is engaged in a discussion with two other rabbis, and they have arguments to allow it and to forbid it, and he has arguments to allow it and forbid it. And the Rebbe seems like an exceedingly generous person, and he goes through each of their arguments and explains, right, how you can justify each of their positions. All right, and they have discussions about whether, right, under what circumstances you can permit nivul hamet, right? Can you permit it for money? Can you permit it to gain medical knowledge? Maybe only relatives can't forbid it, right? And he takes you through through all their arguments and he says, look, I think you, Rabbi Fishel, you're right. My son-in-law, you're right. But the other guy, I don't know, maybe he's a smart young rabbi, so I'm going to defend him. And then at the end of all that, he says, but you're all wrong. And not only you're all wrong, you're all ridiculous. Because either this is pikuach nefesh or it's not. If it's pikuach nefesh, why would I think that nivul hamet of all things should not be permitted for pikuach nefesh? So if it's actually, right, if gaining medical knowledge that saves lives is considered pikuach nefesh, then this is pikuach nefesh, and obviously it's mutter. Now, you may be aware that this was not 100% agreed. The Binyan Sion, right, as the Shuvat of the Aruch Lener, took the position that we paskin like Rashi, and he understands Rashi, which is Pashup Shat and Rashi, that you cannot destroy someone else's property to save a life, and therefore Kal v'chomer, you can't be menavel hamet. Right, because that's you can't impose that on the dead. So he could have taken that approach. It's interesting, like, which people think that is reasonable to take Rashi for real as meaning it, and lehalacha, that you can't save a life by taking property. And other people say, what are you talking about? How could that possibly be? Because nefesh is no kol, right? So that's a whole separate controversy. Right.
So it sounds like from what you're saying, it's not that we have to get into the parameters of Nevil Hames and dignity / desecration of the deceased. It's really just almost a black and white question. Is this pikuach nefesh or not? Because we know that pikuach nefesh is doched, supersedes almost every single mitzvah. This is a well-known concept. So once we determine and label this as genuine pikuach nefesh, then we don't really need to talk about what it's being doched for the most part. Why should Nevil Hames be better than Shabbos or anything else?
Exactly right. Except unless you hold like that Rashi, which the Binyan HaTzion eventually will. I should say the beginning of the tshuva is important for issues like, you know, for issues about burial processes and things, reburial, right? All sorts of, you know, the question of whether Nevil Hamate is permitted for Kvod Hamate, right? All those issues are important. And one could have discussed the issue in terms of whether it is Kvod Hamate to be studied medically or not, right? That's a really interesting question. But the Noda Biyudah himself, right, does not address, right, he only addresses those sorts of issues when he's talking about his, right, the positions of the people who were sent to him. He himself thinks the only issue is this pikuach nefesh or not.
Right. And so just for our listeners, I know certainly you read the tshuva and I looked over the tshuva as well, but for our listeners who maybe not had a chance to read over the tshuva at the beginning, initially, he seems to work with a framework that he says there's this value or thing we're supposed to be preventing of nivol ubizayon lemes on one hand, that we shouldn't be desecrating the dead. And then there's a value on the other hand called hatzalas nefashos to save lives. And then he reckons with this idea, maybe zehu kavod hames lios revach v'hatzala yadol etzorachom. Like you said, maybe it's not just simply that it's hatzalas nefashos that is superseding the value of respecting the deceased, but actually it's like a hutra. It's a kiyum, it's a fulfillment of kavod hames, that it should be used for such a holy purpose of preserving life.
So he thought, right? So he has, right, all those are, one of the things I think we'll see about this tshuva is that the psaki issues is really on an abstraction and doesn't tell you so much what to do in the real case. And that's an interesting thing as well. Sometimes you have a psak which is really, really clear about the outcome, but right, you're not really sure which grounds. Here is really, really clear about one of the grounds, and then he leaves open all sorts of interesting possibilities in terms of what you would actually do.
It seems that, you know, again, just going through the tshuva, you mentioned also, I do appreciate how deferential he is to all the different opinions before he says, you guys don't know what you're talking about. He says, for instance, va'amnam lefisha ein ani yodea mihu ha'oser, I don't know who's taking the more prohibitive stance, v'ulait super me rabbanon hu, darki l'chapei schus, you know, I'm going to try to figure out what's, these are all intelligent people, I'll try to understand their arguments. And it's very remarkable, actually, just from a methodological standpoint. He says, I want to really put myself in the shoes of all the different sides. But then at the end, all of a sudden he turns around and he says, I still don't understand what you guys are talking about. Like you said, if it's pikuach nefesh, why do we need all these backflips? You know, something I get a kick out of all the time. We do this a lot in the modern Orthodox world. Eschatani mesker hayom, I do the same, where I'll get up there for a shiur or for something else. And I'll say, you know, there's a tension between value A and value B. And then you give a whole shiur and then the answer is, and then the maskana is, that's about living through the tension. So we do that all the time, right? Collectively. But what the Noda Biyudah is saying is, you know, guys, not everything needs to be like this tension. Sometimes one side is just very clear and obvious, and it's just, I guess, the question it asks us to address is, when is something pikuach nefesh, right? If we determine it's pikuach nefesh, it's dochem. But the real question, this I think is the chiddush you want to get to in the Noda Biyudah, is, well, how do we determine when something is pikuach nefesh? And I'll just editorialize for 2 seconds, then I'll let you come back. Which is, I think during the era of COVID, a lot of the public learned the term pikuach nefesh who weren't familiar with it yet. And there was, I'll say in very clear terms, a lot of real legitimate pikuach nefesh going around in COVID. No question about that. But if you if you're like me, who spends too much time on Facebook and Twitter and other social media outlets, you'll see that the term pikuach nefesh just gets thrown around like many other ideas, and people aren't always reckoning with what are its actual parameters. It's not just for me, Moshe Kearns, in social media to say, well, you know, eating pizza could be pikuach nefesh, or eating meat could be pikuach nefesh, therefore we don't no longer eat these things. It takes real research. And so I think that's what the important part of this note to be Yehuda is he's about to tell us, how do we determine when something meets the threshold of pikuach nefesh, that we can avail ourselves of its privileges, for lack of a better term.
Sure, of course. I'm going to end up living through the tension anyway, because there's a price to pay for calling things pikuach nefesh, and there's a price to pay for not calling things pikuach nefesh. Nobuda takes an approach, so I want to show you what his approach is, but I don't want you to think that his approach is koveya the halacha. I think that what he did was, what you were talking about. He said, this is one case where we have to draw a bright line. But one of the things we'll see often is that the attempt to draw a bright line doesn't always work. And that's really, and then we can ask the question whether a bright line really is the best approach.
Right.
There are models. I talk often about, because my father was an electrical engineer, Lava Shalom, the difference between analog switches and digital switches. Digital switches are, have fixed positions. It can only be in a certain set of, on-off is the easiest example of a digital switch. Whereas an analog switch can be turned all the way, and every single point has significance. So in halacha, you often have to choose between digital switches and analog switches. Analog switches are, when you have proportionality, the more intense this factor is, so you could say pikuach nefesh is a sliding scale. The more pikuach nefesh it is, the more we're matir. The less, the further it is from pikuach nefesh, the less we're matir. That's a different approach. And in pikuach nefesh, we are challenged by the claim that ein holchin pikuach nefesh achar harov, which seems to suggest that odds are not a factor in pikuach nefesh. And once odds are not a factor in pikuach nefesh, so why should anything else be a factor in pikuach nefesh, right? If there's a one in a million chance that this will, and there's a reductio ad absurdum that we can get rid of by saying, yeah, it has to be often when you're talking about distant future, so we don't know which way the odds are improved, right? Yes, there's a one in a million chance that will lead to pikuach nefesh, but it might lead to 50 other things that kill you first, right? So maybe eating meat is not the clear case. But one of the challenges pikuach nefesh dovah et hakol is that it tends to, for lack of a better word, metastasize. It has the risk of taking over all of halacha. Rabbi Tendler, your Rebbe, Alav HaShalom, has two different articles, one in Hebrew and one in English, and they give you very different perspectives. In Hebrew, he has an article, as I understand it, saying, if pikuach nefesh is dovah et hakol, then that would mean that running a country would be nothing more than all your money would have to go to healthcare. There'd be no room left for museums. Do we really want a life in which there are no museums? Right? There's nothing to live for. All there is pikuach nefesh. In his English version, he talks about watching this giant mower on the New Jersey Turnpike, and asking why is it worth spending money to mow the lawn on the New Jersey Turnpike? Right? When there are hospitals that need money. Now it could be that mowing the lawn on the Jersey Turnpike actually contributes to saving lives because of something about traffic visibility and things like that, or that that massive depression happens if you drive endless distances as you do in New Jersey along highways, right, with unmowed grass. It could be that has diminishes the mental health of everybody in New Jersey radically if we didn't mow the lawn. But those are the issues, right? That on the one hand, saying pikuach nefesh is dovah et hakol, if we take that as an absolute value statement, leaves no room to live.
Right. And so I think the note of Yehuda, toward the end of the tshuva, he basically makes this claim that it becomes a reductio ad absurdum. He says, if we're just going to invoke Bikuach Nefesh casually like this, Imkein Yinasku Kol HaMeisim DeLimod Sidur Avram HaPanim Mehusan Kadei SheYedu Lazarus L'Chaim. You know, like, we'll just cut up, and this is what you were describing historically, we'll just cut up everyone in order, you know, because it's under the rubric of Bikuach Nefesh. So how do we make sure to deal with Bikuach Nefesh in a way that is serious, that we give it its due reverence, because saving lives is a supreme value, but how do we make sure that we don't abuse this principle at the same time? And I think this brings us really to perhaps the most famous part, I think, at least to me, I shouldn't say famous, to me it's the most iconic part of the tshuva, is where he says, "V'amnam kol zeh b'yish safik sakanas nefashos lifaneinu." Lifaneinu, when there is actual Bikuach Nefesh right in front of us. Now, what's right in front of us mean? But when there's an issue that's in front of us, that's when we could say we could cut up a body, we could do an autopsy to help someone who is before us, who we need to figure out the refuah. Not in the abstract, but a practical case right in front of us. And I think this has led to a lot of discourse about how do we define, what does it mean, literally in front of us, available somewhere in the world, somewhere? How do we even draw the line? And this, of course, comes to the point that you're making, which is it this binary of on and off, or is there some sort of sliding scale? And I'd love for you to speak to that.
Sure. So let's talk two things. One is, you talked about the slippery slope with regard to autopsies, but yes, the second line that I think is really worth saying, it says that if we were to allow this, we would have to allow all medical training, right? And not only that, hospitals, right? It says, so let's actually read that whole section and hold it. I think it's really important to watch what he does. He says, but nowadays, in our case, sorry, there's no specific sick person who needs us to autopsy that other patient. Right. They just want to learn this because maybe at some point a patient will present themselves who need this. So that's his first huge move, right? To claim that, setting a bright line that not only is not matir d'oraisas, it's not matir d'rabbanans. That's not at all obvious.
Wow.
Right? There's no reason for him to say that, you know, unless he really believes it or thinks it's necessary. Then he says, if you call this concern safek nefasho pikuach nefesh, imken ye kol meleches harefuos, all the infrastructure of medicine, shechikat uvishul samimanim, the preparation of medicines, v'achanas kli izem el hakaza, and sharpening needles to bloodlet, butcher b'shabbos would be permitted on Shabbos because maybe a patient will show up. So what he says is that if you don't draw some kind of line, so autopsies, I'm learning now, so the next patient will show up. Well, what happens if I need to run a factory on Shabbos? Because, right, maybe there won't be enough medicines available unless I run the factories 24/7. Maybe all cancer labs should run 24/7, because maybe if you don't run 24/7, you'll miss a discovery that will save many, many lives. So he thinks there's a reductio ad absurdum slippery slope. But now here's the thing. How much evidence does he cite that this distinction exists?
I don't see any citations to academic journals here.
Or to halakhic sources. What he says is that the standard sources that he's dealing with all, in his mind, address something that you can call lifaneinu. But he has no source that says cholish ein lifaneinu is not Pikuach Nefesh. Right? So this is an amazingly radical move, right? He claims that, right, I would have thought Pikuach Nefesh, Doche Tarov, right? Where do you get this concept of Lifaneinu? Right? And I'm sure that, you know, if you analyze these sources, you'll see they're not exactly Lifaneinu. They don't require a physical presence, right? Do we say only the people in the presence of the guy who had a wall fall on him? They're the only ones who should be in Fakir? You call a guy for the next town, right? They're not right. They were two streets over who didn't see the wall fall. You can't, right? They can't dig him out on Shabbos, right? That's absurd, right? So really, all the evidence is against him, and despite that, right, and with no evidence, he constructs this amazing category, and he tells you why, because the alternative is impossible.
So he's forced to create his own parameter, his own limitation, because without it, the conclusion is untenable.
Yes. So he came up, he's looking for a standard that he can use that lets him control the impact of Goach Nefesh in Halakha, and he comes up with a brilliant standard that works briefly. And then, well, I'll quote my father again. I love it. My father, you know, like loved to ask his classes, when was speed of light communication instituted? And people always think 20th century, and then he would point out the Mishnah, you know, about Masiyah and Masu and Rosh Hashanah, right? Where he has speed of light, it's the algorithm that was lacking, not the information, and then you just wave at somebody. That's speed of light communication. Right. But when you get the capacity to really convey all the way around the world, so once you have speed of light communication, right, practically around the world, every chol is lefanenu, obviously.
Yeah, and I'd be remiss if we didn't talk about its implications. I think you mentioned Rav Tendler, Zichron Levracha, in the major organ donation debate. And the obviously time of death is one of the discussions over here. But one of the considerations that I think advocates had to deal with also about harvesting organs was the question of nivul hames, of desecration of the body. But if we say nowadays, with the communication and the travel abilities that we have, this term, this category, lefanenu, is useful for the Noda B'Yehuda. But for us, I mean, I guess one could argue it is very useful because it then enables organ donations, because there's going to be someone somewhere that's going to need some organ to help them. In fact, there's unfortunately very long lines of people waiting for organs. And I'm wondering if, you know, how we would even apply that standard nowadays, or do we need a new standard? And what does it even mean for us to make up a standard? You know, can we go, obviously the Noda B'Yehuda is Noda B'Yehuda, but how do we even go about making up these standards if we don't have precedent for them? What does that mean methodologically?
Right, so that's a great question. So I would point out, like, the organization, Noda B'Yehuda creates the problem, right? Because he tells you that, of course, organization should be mutter for Pikuach Nefesh, assuming the patient's already dead. But he created a problem because he wanted to control autopsies. And we don't have the same interest in controlling organ donation as we have in controlling autopsies. So that's right. That's really the issue. But it came up, you know, it came up. Autopsies became so vital to national medicine that Rav Herzog and Sridi Eichel already said, well, it has to be different when you have your independent country. It has to be different when all medical knowledge is pooled. It has to be different in when you just have many, many more patients. Where this came up, some of the cases where this came up, ventilator use. Can you hold a ventilator for the next patient who will need it more? Mm. Right? Or do you only have to consider the cholosh or lefanenu? Cases that came up during COVID, give you two kinds of cases. These are both cases I was asked. One is somebody who is working for the distribution of existing masks properly. Right, and the masks will be distributed less rapidly if the person doesn't go into work on Shabbos. Hmm. As opposed to somebody who is making masks. Can they make masks on Shabbos? Let's leave aside the question of whether of the utility of masks and saving lives and things like that. Let's assume at that time that it was a reasonable assumption. It may still be true that masks save lives and that these were the kind of masks that would save lives and all kinds of other sorts of equipment.
Sure.
But all sorts of triage questions depended on whether you could only consider the patients currently in the hospital, or you consider in South Africa, or Sterbel came up with an idea of patients en route, patients statistically en route, all sorts of ways of expanding Kolothenu that way. In the Entebbe Tshuva, Rav Avadia uses this the other way around to claim that when you release it, right, when they were considering hostage negotiations, a fascinating Tshuva, which ends with, and while we were debating the halakha, the prime minister came in and told us that they had freed, right, that they had freed them. So all our debates were halakhically irrelevant. But one of the arguments he makes in that is that you can prove that in the Buddha, that you don't have to worry about future deaths from releasing terrorists in order to free hostages, because your concern is the person in Pikuach Nefesh lefanenu.
Hmm.
Right? Now that's an interesting argument. I think a lot of us would probably bristle at that claim that you only, you know, that use of lefanenu to say that the state doesn't have to worry about long-term missions. I want to make one other point. The Malamed Lohoyo, not but sorry, no, again, the Binyan Letzion. You get my Germans confused. The Binyan Letzion, who, as I mentioned earlier, takes Rashi really seriously, that you cannot, because Nefesh doesn't allow you to impose costs on a third party, and therefore Nivul HaMeit is not permitted, even for Pikuach Nefesh, just like theft is not permitted even for Pikuach Nefesh, even if you intend to pay it back. He says, but consent is enough. Because, right, and now if you go back to another dude, I want to point out, like, something that really early is pointed out, people don't appreciate this. Right, at the very end of the Shuvah, he says, he says that, in fact, maybe, right, even the doctors of the Gentile world don't engage in dissection for knowledge of what is a key in except for convicted criminals, which now we have a deep hesitation for. That's the big issue, about China in many ways. Or with somebody who agreed in their lifetime to do this. But now that's the stage that we certainly don't have to do it in cases where they don't. But the question is, should we do it in cases where they do? Right? So he never tells you in this tshuva that it's forbidden with consent.
That's true. He does leave that open.
Yeah. And right, why should right? And that's not a right, that's the, what's the issur? Right, if it's kavod hamet anyway for knowledge to be gained that way, and if he consents, then he considers it as covered. So this tshuva, which is often used to prevent autopsies, it is a challenge that has to be overcome in place. Right, if you think that autopsies are critical for medical knowledge, and in the same way as with organ donation, you can't create a circumstance where Jews accept but don't contribute. Actually, there's no right in this tshuva. You could come out saying that that autopsies are always permitted with consent.
That's an interesting reading. I thought that the way I read it was he was trying to say that even in the non-Jewish world, they have a standard. They're not just going to throw all the bodies for autopsies. He gives examples. He says either someone is a criminal or someone who consented to it. I didn't get the sense, at least from my reading, that he was saying, and therefore we should adopt these as a standard. I thought he was just trying to say, even in the Umos HaOlam, recognize that a line needs to be drawn somewhere.
Right. So that, I think that yeah. He doesn't say it. He also doesn't not say it. Now we go back, as you pointed out, to the earlier tshuva, where he acknowledges the possibility that Nivul HaMeit can be covered.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and now we ask, now, so then we get into much interesting questions about public policy. What would have happened if he had said Jews can be autopsied with consent? So one of the things you have to do in all sorts of contract law is not to put people in situations where their consent will be coerced.
Right.
And so, right? So I don't know, right? I think he's very careful not to tell you what the halakha is in situations like that, because it may be that a ruling like that would be used to yield the same result. So I agree with you. He doesn't say it's mutter. I also think that he doesn't say it's usher. And if I were just making an authority argument, I'd say, okay, but ain't something mostly me nevada. The Binyan Tzion says it's explicitly mutter, right? The dispute is unclear. I could just go that way. I don't know that's the right way to go halacha either, right? I'm not engaged in psak right now. But I think, and I hope this has shown you, like, how first of all, what a really cool tshuva it is, how creative it is. How the creativity is engaged in removing the sources. And when he's removed all the sources, right, then he has, he comes up with an incredibly creative move. And it was, I think, an incredibly successful move, but one that had time limit on it. And I'll just give you an analogy. Some of the things we said about electricity.
It always comes back to
right,
that.
Worked really well for a while. And are now just totally breaking down with technological progress. And the same kind of situation where you might say, well, that's halacha, we're stuck with it because we decided that 100 years ago. Or it might be, the, as with autopsy, you just say, you know what? What he did was try and navigate this tension. And now we need to navigate the tension differently because the way he gave it, the way he did it, doesn't work for us anymore.
Excellent. And I really appreciate now why you chose this tshuva, not just because of its halacha lemaisa, its practical import, but also methodologically, in which we see the limits of how far precedent can take us. And then we have to rely on the innovation of Gedolei HaPoskim, like the Notabi Yehuda, to try to figure out, in the absence of a clear precedent, how do we make sense of these new developing situations? And that's what's really remarkable about the world of Shutim and modern Psak Halacha, as you so articulately said, with electricity. So, and certainly, Rabbi Clapper, I know you're on the forefront as a posek, figuring out how to make sure Halacha is able to address the challenges of our reality as Jews in America, Jews in the 21st century. And again, I want to encourage our listeners, we'll put a link in the description, Amir Tzashem, ways to continue learning from Rabbi Clapper. Rabbi Clapper is an excellent resource for understanding Torah in a Lishma sense, and of course in the practical sense as well. So Rabbi Clapper, I want to really thank you for your time, for sharing your wisdom. And this was such an excellent way to break down a tshuva. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me. Always enjoy. Look forward to learning again soon.
Absolutely. Take care, Rabbi Clapper. Thank you for listening to Shoot First, Ask Questions Later. Please make sure to subscribe to get the latest updates. And if you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate us and leave a review. Do you have a response to the response that you want to share on the show? Please send your letter to the editor to MitchellMKurtz@gmail.com. And God willing, we would love to consider your perspective to be shared on a future episode. This is Moshe Kurtz, and I look forward to reviewing more responses with you next time on Shoot First, Ask Questions Later.